And I will tell you, I will spoil this.
Don't what? Go ahead. Don't you take my Build-A-Bear.
Okay, I'll.
Do not steal my Build-A-Bear.
All right, I won't.
You can follow up on the Build-A-Bear. I was like, is that like Build-A-Bear? And you can say, I don't know if Build-A-Bear knows.
Okay.
All right. Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. So this week, we talk with Dr. Caitlin Handren with Ropes & Gray's Insight Lab on how she and her team are helping clients make informed decisions, confront the realities of human biases, and create solutions that prioritize individual experiences and needs by applying analytics, behavioral science, and human-centered design.
That's easy for you to say.
Yeah, that was a mouthful. You know, and it's really interesting that the R&G Insight Labs hired a behavioral scientist to lead this charge in helping clients understand what makes better risk decisions. And, you know, we kind of joke in the interview that maybe it might help if the law firms kind of turn that focus inside and use behavioral scientists to look at how we behave.
Yeah, so stick around for that. But now let's get to this week's Information Inspirations.
All right, Marlene, mine is from one of our previous guests, Olga Mack. She's got a Bloomberg Law article on preparing for the no-code and low-code age of law.
Amen.
Both of my inspirations have to deal with no-code and low-code.
Yeah.
So in this article, Olga says that according to a Gartner report, legal departments will have automated some 50% of their legal work by 2024, with most of that automation being through the low-code or no-code application platforms, which will allow lawyers to create processes without actually having to do any hardcore programming. And just to kind of explain a little bit, the no-code options are things that allow lawyers to automate processes easily. And the simplest example she gives is an option to have software save changes to a document every 5 minutes. So it's, you know, pretty simple things. Mm-hmm. And no-code also includes some of the simple drag-and-drop options for users to help pre-build solutions that they may use multiple times. Now, low-code solutions are those which may take the initial effort of a software developer, but which give the end user a, you know, better and more intuitive design and user-friendly interface. And Olga gives three simple examples of things to do to prepare for the no-code future. And that is, become familiar with today's no-code platforms, assess where you, your lawyers, and your legal staff are in use of no-code apps right now, and finally, keep an eye on the no-code movement as it progresses. So there are some legal-based products out there like NeodaLogic and others which tout no-code capabilities. And, you know, we talked about that NYU program a few weeks ago on the No-Code Sports League and their use of products like Bubble to help create no-code apps. So if you're not on the no-code train yet, you might want to get on there now before the train fills up.
Yeah, so basically I have to follow hashtag no code.
Hashtag no code.
Hashtag no code. And, you know, I will say, speaking of your NYU platform, or the program rather, I tried to do that for voice. I couldn't figure out how to get in. So I'm just saying. So.
I'll be quiet.
So. My first inspiration is regarding an article that Ryan Stedman posted, and it was an interesting article he wrote about the rising cost of mental fatigue and how technology is the solution as well as the problem at law firms. Now, the way firms have traditionally operated, ambitious billable hours, constant interruptions, and so many administrative tasks lead to mental exhaustion, in some cases, burnout syndrome. And yes, that is a real thing, according to the WHO. So what it is you're mentally exhausted, you're mentally distant, negative about your job, and as a result, and not surprisingly, you are less effective professionally.
Does this apply in the legal industry? I don't understand.
I don't know. It's like ringing any bells here. So a way technology can prevent mental fatigue and burnout syndrome is to eliminate the speed bumps that can drag down productivity. For example, having to log in and out of everything rather than having a single sign-on. Not being able to find content because there's no standard naming convention or AI to figure that out. Having to learn multiple digital toolkits. I mean, this all contributes to the yuck of every day. and Ryan recognizes that choosing the right technology to promote a positive experience is notoriously difficult, to say the least. But there are a few questions to answer before instituting a tech solution. Will there be an immediate value and improvement to the daily work experience? Is the design user intuitive? And does the proposed solution integrate with the existing workflow? And here I'm going to add something of my own. Does it improve the workflow in the user's eyes? And that's not so easy to assess. You really have to invest some time and effort to dig deep into looking at the problem and really putting yourself in the end user's place. So it's not only having a formal discussion about requirements, it's about exhibiting empathy to find an appropriate roadmap and solution.
So Marlene, my follow-up on the no-code, low-code topic has to deal with Wilson Sonsini's Build-A-Bot program for summer associates.
Aw, is that like Build-A-Bear?
Yeah, I think they do a robot and then they dress it in baby clothes at the end of summer.
Do they put a little heart inside?
They do.
No.
Actually, I hate to disappoint you. That's not anything what it's about. So.
All right, well, tell me what it is.
So according to an article in Artificial Lawyer, Wilson Sonsini is requiring that their summer associates participate in this Build-A-Bot program where they need to work with products like DocuMate or this year's partner, which is a Contract Mill, to create some type of automated or improved process in their workflow. So the summer associates will conceptualize and build their own document automation workflows. And to me, it's interesting that Wilson Sonsini is doing this with the summer associates, as it seems to me that they're either going to be the best or the worst at identifying ways to improve the overall process. So, you know, hopefully they're the best in that they haven't developed bad habits over their career. But I'm also guessing that people like Wilson Sonsini's Chief Innovation Officer, David Wang, that he's going to be there to make sure that they are using the tools effectively and understanding what the processes are that they are improving. And again, hopefully at the end of the summer, they have a cute little robot that they can dress up.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. There really is something to be said for, you know, the beginner mindset. And, you know, perhaps the summer associates are really actually a good batch to come at this without any real prior knowledge as to how things are done. You know, they're just looking at it really differently. And this one is to file under, whoops, my bad. New York federal prosecutors investigating Rudy Giuliani have seized material from a wider group of people than they have previously disclosed. How do we know that? The magic of technology. The court filing where the information was obtained looked fine on the surface, but had redacted portions that, when CNN cut and pasted it into another document, amazingly appeared.
Jeez.
Embarrassing, to say the least.
Yeah.
Prosecutors had previously indicated that their investigation was expansive, but they had not publicly identified the other recipients of subpoenas or subjects of search warrants. Law Twitter had some fun with this one, of course. Our friend Casey Flaherty noted quite rightly that this is not just about technical competence, but meeting professional obligations. And my advice is redact properly, people.
Yeah. This is like every week now, there seems to be some thing, and it's so simple. It's literally copy and paste from the PDF to Word. So, Oh, well. Well, hopefully we don't have to redact any of this. So then that wraps up this week's Information Inspirations. Well, today's guest is a PhD in behavioral science, and she's working with a law firm to help guide clients through the understanding of risk and how to avoid it, or at least know how risk affects their businesses. We'd like to welcome cultural psychologist Dr. Caitlin Handren, senior lab consultant and behavioral scientist with Ropes and Gray's RNG Insights Lab. Dr. Handren, thanks for taking the time to talk with us on The Geek in Review.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I have to say, if you would have told me a while ago that there was a behavioral scientist at a law firm, I would have assumed that she was studying the behavior of the lawyers that were actually working in the firm, not necessarily advising the attorneys on how to better understand the work of the firm's clients. So, you know, first of all, can you just tell us a little bit about your work and focus there and why Ropes and Gray brought you into the firm as an advisor?
Sure, of course. And I would say it's not necessarily that I'm not paying attention to what the lawyers are doing. I'm just not specifically there for that reason.
That's just a side project, huh?
Yep. I am a cultural psychologist by training, which means when I was getting my PhD, I got my PhD recently at Stanford working with a cultural psychologist. I was specifically interested in how individual psychological processing is shaped by the broader cultural context. So how do the big ideas about what is good, right, and moral get trickled down through institutions, get embodied in policies and law? How does that then shift down into how people are interacting with one another? So what's happening at the social norms level? How are people attending to their peers or their leaders to decide what's right and what they should be doing? And then ultimately, how does that trickle down to the individual? How does that affect psychological processing? And so I'd say I was brought on because they were very interested in this cultural perspective. We can understand a lot about human behavior. There's so much to understand. There's so much to learn. And especially the more that we uncover about how people are irrational, I think we have a lot of gut instincts, intuitions about why people are doing what they're doing. But the more research comes out, the more we can see that people aren't necessarily logical. They're following their biases. They're behaving in ways that don't make sense to us. And so I'd say that what's really incredible about what the lab is doing is that they're recognizing that just policies and procedures aren't necessarily going to be enough. People are going to step around them. They're going to take that compliance manual and just put it on the shelf and never read it again. There's a huge human component going on here that is not being attended to. And what they're doing at the lab is pulling together a multidisciplinary team to really try to close some of those gaps so that we have not only this incredible legal perspective, but also the perspective of human psychology. Why are people doing what they're doing? What are they going to do what you ask them to do versus not do it? And so on.
So I'm just curious, did you reach out to Ropes and Gray about this and pitch this idea? Or how did Ropes and Gray actually think to bring in a behavioral psychologist in the first place?
I think that was always part of their ambition. The lab started last July, so it hasn't been that long that the lab has been in place. And I think from the beginning, they saw this as a very team-based project. And so they wanted a behavioral scientist from the beginning. And I was brought on because I was responding to a posting that they put out there in the world asking for a behavioral scientist.
Caitlin, you mentioned that, you know, you're looking at, again, why people do what they do and you know, why just rules aren't enough. And I'm assuming that also as part of the role of the lab is that you're offering solutions as to how to, you know, how to improve upon, you know, maybe some of these circumstances where there might be friction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are three main focuses of the lab. There's compliance and risk, diversity, equity and inclusion initiatives, and cultural assessments. And I'd say that there's a lot of room for behavioral science and data to enter into each of those different components.
Yeah, so I'd far, agree.
I have been spending quite a bit of time on the diversity, equity, inclusion, and cultural assessment side of things because that is where my training is. That's where I have quite a bit of experience so far. And then on that third pillar, I've been learning a lot about compliance and risk. I think, again, this is the beauty of being on teams. I don't necessarily have to be the expert in the legal world, but it has been fascinating to learn about it. And I do think that by taking the cultural psychological perspective, we are able to come up with solutions. We're able to brainstorm and think through why are things happening the way that they are. And one of the key parts of what we do is we try to understand the culture of the organization in order to come up with solutions that might happen all across the organization. So not just changing the policies or not just training the trainings, but really focusing on how can you make some cultural shifts to get some of the behavior that you're hoping to see.
You know, you mentioned that the R&G Insight Lab is a consulting arm of Ropes and Gray. And, you know, how does this operate alongside the legal practice of Ropes and Gray, the law firm? You know, do you work with particular practice areas, or is this sort of more of a standalone operation and you just sort of offer general insights? How does that work?
It's more of a standalone. They intentionally didn't want to couch it within a certain particular practice area. And
did they not want the lawyers running it?
You know, that's some of the culture that I'm still finding out a lot about. I've heard the term non-lawyer thrown around quite a bit. So I'm beginning to identify that way.
Just tell them that's Dr. Non-Lawyer to you.
To you.
Yeah, it's more of a standalone operation. And I think the idea behind it is how could we be a one-stop shop for clients? And so we're definitely there to support. We are there for Ropes and Gray, and we do participate in conversations with the other legal team's clients. But I'd say that we are also here to meet our own clients and step out as a consulting branch that has both the legal side of things as well as the more human-centered approach.
You know, one of the, I think this may have been the first pillar you talked about, the compliance and risk part. You know, one of the things that lawyers really pride themselves on is being the issue spotters, you know, that we mm-hmm. can assess the risk and we can work with our clients to help mitigate the existing risk or even change the behavior for potential exposure to risk. So I imagine that, you know, many of the lawyers or those who are legally trained may be listening to this podcast and may think that, hey, this is something that we're already doing to help our clients with the risk. So what's the difference that they are thinking that they are doing when it comes to compliance and risk and what the R&G Insights Lab is doing when it comes to compliance and risk?
This has been it's such a great question. And I think it's one that I've really been grappling with since entering into this space. I, of course, don't want to be stepping on any toes. And there's so much incredible work that's already being done in these spaces. I, of course, can enter and flippantly say something about human behavior being really hard to decipher and very hard to follow. When people have built their entire careers doing investigations and coming up with compliance. And so what do we have to contribute in this space? I'd say it's really that new perspective. It's not necessarily that we are here to do anything better or replace anything that's already existing, but it's in order to come in and say that there might be pieces that are being overlooked. And one perspective, for example, behavioral science has become a very flashy term that gets thrown around a lot. People are very interested in what behavioral science is and how it can serve us. And one perspective that I have, especially coming from my department that does a lot of work on cultural psychology, is recognizing that a lot of what we know about human behavior is actually very specific from Western countries, weird countries are how they are identified in my field, Western educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. Yeah. Nearly 85% of the research.
Yeah. Somebody worked really hard to make it say weird.
Yes.
Very brilliant scholars out there, absolutely. Yeah, they call us weird, and they identified that about 85% of the research that we have, it comes from weird populations. And so when we think about what we know about human behavior, it's actually very limited. And so I think what a cultural perspective has to offer is to say that there's a lot more going on under the surface. There's a lot more that we can understand by thinking through what are the broader factors influencing people. And so that's a perspective that psychology itself needs to learn. So I'm coming from a field where we would bash our heads up against and say, like, there's the rest of the world. There's more than just weird contexts, and there's a lot more that we can understand about human psychology if we're to pay attention beyond what has currently gotten a lot of the focus. And I guess I feel like if my field needs to be hearing that, then there's probably a lot of other contexts that need to be hearing that as well, that there are a lot of places that can learn what it means to take a cultural perspective and what it means to put the human in context and attend to not only some of these biases that are just human cognitive biases according to the behavioral science literature, but also what are some of the broader motivators that are really pushing people to do what they're doing or pay attention to what they're paying attention to. So I'm not sure. That might have been a roundabout answer to say I'm not trying to step on anyone's toes.
So, Caitlin, you've already mentioned that there's a three-pronged mission in helping clients, right, for the lab. It's first to make informed decisions, second to confront the realities of human biases, and third, creating solutions that prioritize individual experiences and needs. To accomplish those goals, you're going to have to apply analytics, behavioral science, and human-centered design. I think we've hit on the behavior science part. But how are you gathering and leveraging analytics?
We are currently in the process of fleshing this out. I'd say that we have people with incredible experience in analytics on our team. I think in the future, we plan to pull in data analysts. We talk a lot about experimentation and how we can even begin gathering the data. So a huge part of the psychological approach, at least how I was trained, is in experimental psychology. So we can use not only our expertise and our training to try to come up with what are potential solutions, but we can also experiment to find out whether or not the data supports what we believe is going to be working. And so I'd say a big part of how we approach everything on the data side of things is to not only measure and track what we're doing, but then to also throw in experimentation when we can, in order to see if things are having the effects that we would want them to have.
Well, I was going to skip over the behavioral science part, but now that I think about it and heard this, we were talking about the human biases. So how are you applying the behavioral science part when it comes to the biases that we all have?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And the way that we approach it is to think through what biases exist. So I guess a lot of people have maybe different ideas of what comes to mind when we talk about these biases. So some people might be thinking about racial biases, some might be thinking about cognitive biases. And one of the ways that we approach this is to look at the literature and understand what has already been done out there in terms of understanding where do people have these biases and how can we intervene. One of the better known biases is to think about things in terms of a fixed mindset as opposed to a growth mindset. Are you familiar with this?
Yes.
Yeah. It's pretty well-known research at this point by Carol Dweck and all the researchers who have followed her. But there's this tendency that is culturally embedded to think about intelligence as fixed instead of as something that has the potential to grow beyond. So that's a place where you can intervene at an organizational level. Like, how do organizations communicate that this is what the expectation is and this is how we view people? And you can also intervene at the individual level to really challenge some of the ideas that people have. In terms of other biases, we do know that one of the best defenses against bias is to slow down. When people are distracted or hungry or tired, they have a tendency to rely a lot more on those biases. So we think through what are those critical points when we really need people to be cognitively free and present and able to be mindful on the task that they're doing? And what are the conditions that we have to set up in order to enable people to come to work in that way? And so we're actually in the process of developing different modules to help people identify some of those key points where they can intervene on their own behavior or on their own, on their own behavior. So, for example, who do people follow on LinkedIn or on their social media? This is one of those key points in terms of understanding are you getting your information? Because a lot of people might not recognize just how biased the inflow of information is from their different sources. Who are the authors that are writing the books that you're reading? Who are the directors and the writers who are putting together the TV and film? So thinking through not only what do we do in the moment to address a bias, but how can we go upstream to try to change some of those biases in the first place? Where are these ideas coming from? And how can we try to change some of the input that people have in order to reduce the bias in the first place?
And it's interesting that, I think there should be some kudos out to the companies that are taking this on, because I think of the recent issue with companies like Coinbase, mm-hmm. where I think they had like a third of their employees quit because they basically shut those conversations down. They said, mm-hmm. you can't have these conversations. So I know that they're uncomfortable conversations. How do you go about and approach a client to engage and have those conversations?
Hmm. I'd say with a lot of patience. And it is...
You too have to slow down, huh?
Yeah. And you probably could have heard it in my voice. Like, you take a deep breath, you reorient, and I think you need to come prepared to really listen and find out where people are at and what do they want. I think at the end of the day, people's priorities may be a little different, but there are some general themes that you could probably pull out. Like, people want to be a good person. They want to show up well in the world. They want to have a life that is respectable. And when you start from a place of recognizing that there are usually good intentions, and especially when you're being invited in for one of these projects, then it means that people are ready to take that next step. And they just might not know what it is. And I think often what we've seen is a lot of accusatory approaches where people are very upset that things haven't changed and they want to see change. And so there can be a lot of urgency. And so the question is, how do you slow down when there is urgency? There are people who have been fighting for change their entire lives, for generations. And so how do you say the number one thing we have to do is slow down? And I think there is a way to both hold the urgency and recognize the importance and be able to have the compassion to say that we're not all at the same place and we're not all ready to have the same conversation, but there is a place where we can find common ground.
Yeah, that's essentially how you keep change moving, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's you're playing the long game.
Yes, exactly.
So I don't know if the lab is more in, exploratory mode at this point, or if there are some concrete examples of successes for applying the behavioral science principles in the firm environment. I'm curious if there's anything that you can share in that regard, sort of letting other firms know why they need to have someone like you and something like the lab for themselves.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I am on my 6th week, so I unfortunately haven't been here.
She's
slowing down, man.
I can say that there are a number of very compelling projects that have come through that I've been able to witness and support. A lot of very forward-thinking approaches to how can we go beyond what's currently being done? How can we pay attention to all the efforts that people are making, but then actually track to make sure that what they're doing is working?
Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back a little bit. You had mentioned your experience at Stanford. So how did your work at Stanford University's Spark think tank prepare you for what you're doing at Ropes and Gray? Are there any behaviors you've run into so far that were unexpected?
So after my PhD, I joined Spark, which is a psychological do tank at Stanford, where they work on bringing psychological theory out into the real world. It was an incredible lab. I'd say that a lot of what frustrates academics is that they're producing all this incredible research, but then it gets tucked away and no one ever reads about it or learns about it. So,
and you said do tank, right?
Yes,
I said. Okay, I just want to make sure. So make sure that I heard that. So, okay, yeah. Well
with
done.
With a little air quotes, yes. this is how they self-identify, and I respect that. And it is wonderful. So they have all the thinking that academia has done, but then they're actually partnering with people to try to pull those insights out into the world. And so one of the projects that I was working on while I was there was looking at racial bias in the financial industry. How does the race of different team leaders affect how asset allocators invest? And so I'd say that that project has felt very related to what we're doing in these spaces, just thinking through how do people make sense of racial bias and where does it show up in these different processes.
Has there been any experience? I know you've only been there 6 weeks, but has there been any experience within the firm environment that or behaviors that you've run into that are may have caught you off guard from your experience of what you had at Spark?
So far, I'd say I haven't necessarily been caught off guard. I think that it's actually remarkable how a lot of these issues transfer across different spaces. So even at Spark, I was working not only on the, you know, with venture capitalists in the asset allocation, but I was also working with in education and healthcare. And a big part of Spark is also working with the Oakland Police Department. And so the projects were incredibly varied. And I think one of the reasons that we are able to work across so many different spaces is exactly because these principles of understanding human psychological behavior really can be applied across a lot of different areas. And so I'd say it isn't necessarily anything new or that's caught me off guard. It's more like finding things that are familiar in a new context. And so there's just so much learning to be done about the context, because the norms, the rituals, the cultures are all very different in the legal space.
Yeah, but once again, the attorneys find out that we're not the unique people that we think we are.
There's some egos to attend to.
And that the grass is not always greener someplace else.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Caitlin Handren, thank you so much for joining us on this interview. This has been great. We've gotten some really great insights, so thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, Marlene, it was great having a behavioral psychologist on the show.
I wonder what insights she gained about us.
I know. I was afraid to say too much. But it's really interesting, and we talked just briefly as after the recording that, man, it'd be nice to have them back and maybe bring along some members of the team mm-hmm. in 6 months and see how this project's going. But it's, you know, I think this is a great idea to have this type of consulting that's built in, but separate from the law practice itself. And it'd really be interesting to see how well this progresses.
Yeah, because I think, you know, many times I think it's really important to kind of have a third party, and certainly in this case, a third party with a lot of expertise, kind of go in and do that type of analysis that they're doing and make recommendations. Because these are really tough issues that we're dealing with. And you know, we're dealing with a lot of, I guess I would say, invisible biases, because again, it's every individual, and it's very individualized based on an individual's experience. So, you know, really having someone come in and kind of, you know, sift through that and figure it out, is something that clearly they're going to be very good at and will also be able to provide great feedback and insights for their clients.
Yeah. Be interesting to see, you know, how they're measuring both what's going on within the clients that they're advising and how they're going to measure themselves as far as success. So,
and what the other thing that was really interesting too is, like, she was talking about how she wasn't really surprised by what she was seeing in firms versus other industries. So it's interesting, even though this is individualized, a lot of it seems to be across the board with people. So again, those analytics I think would be really interesting, and then be able to sort of compare that to other industries and see how that looks.
Yeah. So thanks again to Dr. Caitlin Handren for coming on and talking to us.
Yeah. Thank you, Caitlin. Before we go, we want to remind listeners to take the time to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Rate and review us as well. If you have comments about today's show or suggestions for a future show, You can reach us on Twitter at @GabeBauerM or at Glambert, or you can call the Geek and Review hotline at 713-487-7270 or email us at geekandreviewpodcast@gmail.com. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, I'm going to go check and make sure I redacted things properly.
Yeah, please.